Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 29th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Daily Work and Spirituality, presented by Lynn Rhodes. Disc number RHL-2005-03.
This time with this kind of heat and everything that we can, I mean, you can stay awake. It's just, as a teacher, you never want this hour. I can tell you, you never want this hour of teaching. This is the deadening hour. The other thing is this morning I went for my little spiritual walk. I did the labyrinth and I came back with hay fever. So I don't know what that sounds about spirituality, but something. Have all of you been here before or not? What? How much introduction to do? I guess everybody's been here. The topic today is daily work and spirituality. And I wanted to start with two sort of quotes talking about spirituality. The first one is from Ecclesiastes. And it is, there is nothing better for one to do than rejoice in one's work. There is nothing better to do. I don't know how many people experience that, but that's from Ecclesiastes. And the other one, then, and sort of counter that, is from Julie Poulter. I can't separate questions of work and spirituality from a host of other things, class and privilege, labor and downsizing, the drive to create, the hunger to possess, the call to serve, efficiency and monotony, material needs and spiritual wants, loving my neighbor and expressing myself, savings and being saved, everyday idols and everyday worship, social status and unconditional love, bread and roses. Much work that isn't interesting or fun is vital to human life and to community. And the ones who perform it, whether they're good people, bad people, just plain people, serve as the hands of God's providence. And every day people do work that is underpaid, dangerous, exploitative, or ultimately serving nothing other than someone's profit or another one's destruction. Sometimes, not even the innate God-given dignity of the person doing the job can redeem the work. The distortion is too deep. A woman locked in a wet sweatshop, an international arms dealer, a cigarette industry marketing executive, each is a person reflecting the image of God. But work that is a trap, work that demeans, work that slaughters, work that destroys the soul, is work that cannot be blessed. Searching for an integration of spiritual longing and gifts with work is not an esoteric, trivial, or foolish luxury. Striving for basic justice and dignity for workers is not an unspiritual pursuit. Spirituality includes the call for meaningful work and the call for justice. I'd like to start out in with two definitions of spirituality. There are many, and I'm sure all of you have your own, and there's no such thing as the definition of spirituality. But I want to start out with two that have informed and shaped my sense of what it means. One is from Henri Nouwen, who was a priest and a Catholic worker. And he said, spirituality is making true what is true. And I find that very, very intriguing. That what that would mean for us as Christians is that what God has revealed in the life and death of Jesus is what we say is true. And our work is making true what is true. God said, you know, love is the most powerful, we say God, love is the most powerful reality. So it's making love true. It's making true what is true. The second thing that spirituality is about that I think this has been helpful for me is spirituality is learning to live less fearfully and more open-heartedly. That we can live in the sense that we have a promise of abundant life, and our fears that keep us from moving forward or keep us tight-fisted or that which closes our heart is what kills and destroys our spiritual life and demeans and distorts us. So the question that I want to start with is not what we bring to our work, but how does our work life form us spiritually? Some of the work that Dorothy Bass and others have done on daily faith practices informs my understanding of what I'm talking about here. Protestantism, we have this problem in Protestantism that still, even though we've been trying to act against it for quite a while now, and work like Dorothy's is on faith practices talks about, is that Protestantism very had emphasized the word. Coming out of the Enlightenment, etc., it was the word that was important, that practices were associated with, you know, if you do these little magical things, something magical will happen. But that the word, if you heard the word and understood the word, you would do the word. And what we're understanding now is that that's not really the way it happens. You practice the word, and then you begin to live into the word. That the understanding the word is not enough. It is the practice. And so in that sense, then, what we're beginning to understand is that what we do daily, the practices you do in your daily work for 8 hours a day or 12 hours a day or however many hours a day you are in that mode of being, is forming you. So that where of the practices of our work lives informing our faith. And some of the issues that I think are important when we're thinking about that is that in this culture, the sense of individualism, that who I am is me, and that I make that up somehow, assumes that we bring ourselves to work. But what I'd like to think about is that work brings us to ourselves. What does it, you know, does work shape us? Chris Satullo, in a book called The Lord Catches Us in Our Craftiness, says, make no mistake. Make no mistake, the bus has arrived. The workplace is this nation's great unrecognized church. Each workplace, each profession has its own culture, its own set of values. They are largely unexamined, but they are relentlessly inculcated, relentlessly enforced. For many, this religion is more persuasive, more powerful than anything they observe on Sunday. The second thing that has informed and shaped my understanding about spirituality and work is an old book by Studs Terkel on working. I don't know how many of you have ever read Studs Terkel Working? A couple, yes. That to me says more about, he talks about work, and this is for workers who don't have a voice. It's not professionals, it's not for us who have a lot of choice. It's for workers who carry on the major work of life. Talks about the violence to the spirit of much of our work lives and what that does. And at the same time, the way that people continue to try to get meaning out of their work. And I always think in reading his book that those theories about economic life, that people will only work, you know, if you drive them, if they're gonna starve to death otherwise, that are naturally lazy, etc., is in this book, it's just denied time and again as people search for meaning. And some of the images that I have from that book is one of the waitress, I don't remember this, the waitress who considers as she's delivering food that she's a ballerina. And she dances across the floor and she sets that plate down without a jiggle. And she says, I wonder if they understand what a gift it is that I'm delivering this plate in such a manner. And and I talked about the other day about the guy who resisted what work did to him. There's one woman who talked about being a telephone operator for a hotel. And she said, sometimes at midnight when somebody calls me and says, is this the Marriott? I say, oh no, it's the Red Lion. It's not the Red Lion. I just feel like it. I don't know why. But it's that sense of don't make me a machine. You know, that rebellion is really the spirit crying out. And I find that book to just be giving me such a sense of the spirit of people in all kinds. Or on the other hand, the bridge, the guy who was a bricklayer who went by and said, see that building? 30th floor, my bricks. Those are the kinds of things that I think are, when we talk about spirituality and work, that's what we're talking about, is what it is that in those daily tasks either give us a sense of our significance in the world or diminish us, give us a sense of joy or give us a sense of anger or whatever. And all of that is what forms us spiritually. And why I am so concerned about spirituality and work. Also, as Christians, we affirm that God is the God of all creation. So, on the other hand, we do not bring God to work. God is already there. So the question is, how do we meet God at work? If God is already there. And that's one of the things that, there are three questions I'd like you to think about in terms of your own work life. What nourishes your spirit in your work life? Now, those of us who come here, often we're involved with things because you've come here probably out of a lot of work that is very meaningful to you. So this is not necessarily the first thing. But go back and talk to your friends and ask them these questions. What nourishes you in your work life? Not what do you produce, not what do you, you know, but what nourishes you. And then the second question is, how is God revealed there? What have you learned about God in your work life? And then the third is, what tears at or wears away at your spirit in your work life? And I think we need to ask those questions of ourselves to begin to discover what is happening to our spirit at work. Where is it nourished? Where do we see God revealed? And what is tearing away at our spirit when we come home? Or when we're at home and finish the day, wherever that may be in our work. Now, the further concern I have is the way that work is defined in our culture, that it's defined largely in terms of the workplace and in terms of people going outside the home and pay. And in that field, one of the questions or one of the issues that I have is what is happening in this area. As I said before, I have been reading a lot of the material on spirituality and work, which has become a major, major field of endeavor in these days. That those books sell very well. And they have retreats. There's a man who is a poet who goes and helps people through poetry discover meaning in work. There are all kinds of things that are going on in terms of spirituality in work. And what I am concerned about is that this is a way to manipulate our deep desire for spiritual meaning. That the way that 90% of the books I read, if you read through it, they will talk about all these wonderful things about spirituality, and then you will see the last line will say, and it will increase the productivity of the worker. Well, looking at our economy and what's happening, I think that if we really deepen spirituality, if you don't pay attention to that, I said in this one book, if you don't pay attention and nurture their spirit, their search for meaning, they may become destructive, the workers. So pay attention to their desire for meaning, or they may become destructive. Well, I sort of reverse that and say, if you really deepen their spiritual, worked on their deepening their spiritual life, they would become destructive. Because they would start asking questions. Why are we producing this? What's the meaning of this? Why are we doing this? How are we paying our workers? Why, would start asking the questions of the whole enterprise. But when they keep it narrowed to this individualistic sense of self, and when they keep it internal meaning and not what does it mean in larger things, then spirituality becomes really manipulative. And also, another thing to note in this spirituality thing is that they have made an important, most of these books make an important distinction between spirituality and religion. And they say spirituality is good, religion is bad. And the reason religion is bad is that they say it's particularistic, dogmatic, exclusionary, and rife with First Amendment problems. Whereas spirituality is universal, accommodating, inclusive, and personally empowering. So that what they're doing is divorcing spirituality from content. Now, it doesn't mean that religion isn't all those things. We've all experienced many things in terms of it. But when you say that spirituality is this sort of personally empowering thing that doesn't cause any problems between you and others or any issues to surface, but a more of a sense of personal meaning, then you've left out the content of spirituality. And so I think this is one of the reasons that people talk about, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious. And I always want to say, what do you mean? There's no content to your spirituality? What is going on here? So this is so when you read these things, look at what they're really talking about. And then I want to just, this is for your entertainment tonight, today, this afternoon. I don't know how many of you have seen on the bookshelves, but if you're in the airport, you ought to look for it, because I've seen it there a lot. There's a book called Jesus CEO. Any of you seen Jesus CEO? It's a book written on Christianity and spirituality, and it's called Using Ancient Wisdom for Visionary Leadership. And the author now runs a foundation called the Jesus CEO Foundation. And she calls herself a spiritpreneur. Not an entrepreneur, but a spiritpreneur. And this is what she wrote. This is at the one extreme of this. But it's very popular and sold a lot. I was struck by the fact that Jesus had only 3 years to train 12 people, none of whom were divine, to go out and change the world. And that he trained them so effectively that they went on to do the work after he left. I asked, what did he do with these people to turn them into such lean, clean marketing machines? What skills did he possess that we could duplicate or learn from? She goes on to say that corporations should view their employees' spirituality as an untapped resource, because at least 30% of each employee's potential is underutilized. Her advice is for executives to engage spiritual techniques and productivity and morale will soar. Now this is not the intent of a lot of people. A lot of people write these books out of some real sincere desire. But I think it is terribly dangerous to use spirituality as a way to increase productivity in the workforce. And so that's one of the reasons why I want people to be sort of aware of what's going on. And at the same time, people's deep desire for spiritual meaning. And how do we then begin to support and foster that? Then also, the other thing that's happening spiritually very, very critical is what I've heard called cold evil. Any of you heard that term before, cold evil? It's when we participate in systems where we don't see the result of what we do. It was first applied to bombers, dropping bombs, that when you don't have to encounter the results of what you're doing, it becomes unreal. And so one of the issues for us spiritually is, does our daily work life sort of inculcate this kind of sense of cold evil, that it's not even an emotional, you know, because it's distance, and I don't have to think about the results of that work or what the implications are for the rest of the world. And I think that is one of the spiritual issues that we really are struggling with, because as we said before, and as other people in the room have said, it's very hard to face all the issues about the relationship between what I do and the implications for people in other parts of the world or in my own life. So spiritual issues that I think are important, one is that consumerism creates desire, and that is a spiritual issue of work. Competition creates a way of being in the world. That is a spiritual issue. Defining who is valuable by who gets paid what, about those who are called welfare cheats, those who don't work, those who do, is a spiritual issue. So what is work is spiritually rich. Our work lives just bring up all of these issues about spiritual depth and spiritual and what forms us spiritually or deforms us. So we go back to the thing about spirituality. To make real what is real. Looking for where God is revealed in our work may surprise us. It may be a very different way of going about looking at what happens every day. It may be the absence of God that we experience. It may be the resistance of God. It may be people whose sense of care, compassion, justice surprise us and alert us. But it's a way also of understanding God going before me that gives me incredible gratitude and an ability to have less fear when I start to examine my own life. I don't have to bring God, I don't have to hope God. God is somehow there. And if we are alert for God, we may find in some surprising ways those places in work that can be spiritually enriching and a resource for us. So I think that one of the things that I also want to say is that when we think about work, as we think about spirituality, that we also need to think about our gratitude for whatever it is in our work lives. The other part of spirituality is the gratitude for what it is in our spirit, in our work, that does sustain and nourish us. I have a colleague who is an ethicist, and he says that all ethical life comes out of gratitude. I think, and that the spiritual depth is, that the spiritual gift is gratitude for our lives. So when we think about work, I also want to give you a quote from Fran Peavy, who's been a worker for justice, and she's an older woman who's, you know, faced about as many disappointments as you can in work life and what she has done and what's been overturned that she thought she was creating and all of this. But this is her final statement. Good work is all about love, really, anyway. Love of all life, love of connection, love of growth, love of learning. More than anything, I don't want to have lived and not known what was happening in my own time. What a time to be alive. There are no ideas that are totally taped down. No ideology is adequate to the tasks of this time. So it is a time for really alive, innovating people. It is great to be alive. So in spite of all the things that I've talked about in terms of work, I do think also that this, that our work is, can be such an enlivening part of our lives if we see it as this opportunity to discover within whatever situations we are, those moments, those places where God is working. I was also talking to the first group about my own spirituality, and then I was told all my life that I wasn't very spiritual because I'm really not a retreat contemplative type person. And so I realized that nature, I like it, but it's the bugs and all kinds of things that irritate me. But that what I really do for my spiritual sustenance is I walk the streets of the city. And it's sort of like in work. It depends how I'm looking, with what eyes I'm looking. And one of the images that sustains me over and over is a little kid working. He was a shoeshine kid on a very rainy day, cold day at Christmas time. And he was, of course, nobody was getting their shoes shined on rain. And so I was just looking at him. He picked up, it's Christmas time, and on the other corner was a Salvation Army with a guy with a little bucket. He took some coins out of his own little bucket and went over and dropped them in the Salvation Army bucket. Now, God was revealed to me. That the spirit, it just continues to break through, and that's sort of in our work lives what to look for, is where that spirit breaks through. So I'd like to just open it up with your own musings on what it is in your own work, where you find God revealed, what you find that shapes and sustains you, and what do you feel is deforming of your spiritual life, as you think about your own work. We have a smaller group. Oh, or anything else you'd like to talk about?
I'm a community college instructor in Sacramento. I remember when I got hired 6 years ago, I loved this department. I mean, it fed me. I didn't really have to do much, but I got a lot from the department. And we've undergone about 30% turnover in the department, and we've gotten a lot of new faculty. And our budget in California, I don't know, has been decimated. So it's work has been more difficult because they keep coming to us every year. Okay, you're going to do more with less. You're going to teach more students, but we're not going to give you quite as much money. And I can remember, 6 years ago, one of my colleagues who is one of the people who retired, and I just was going, oh, Linda, I'm so excited in this place. It's so phenomenal. And she sat me down and she says, Kathy, it's not always going to be like this. Enjoy today and get fed, because eventually, and she didn't use these words, but I think about it, you're going to come to the wilderness time and then it's going to be harder, and you have to, basically have the stores so that you can get through the wilderness. And I think, when you get really frustrated at work, you have to think, okay, is this a short wilderness? Is it a long wilderness?
And what's in the wilderness that can be restored?
That was really, because I was new faculty. I had just come out of grad school. And that was really good wisdom for me. Mm-hmm. Because I thought it was always going to be like this. You know, I had no idea, but it's, yeah, I've come back to those words many times.
Yeah, yeah. And what sustains you in the wilderness? Have you figured that out?
No, in fact, we're, as a faculty, we're really struggling right now. And we're trying to figure out what is sustaining us. And there are a few of us who get together here and a few here, but we've not come together to really answer that question yet. We're hoping it's a short-term wilderness. I think right now we're still operating like that, okay, after this year, it'll be better. You know, so we're waiting to see how that all works.
What do you think happens to your spirit there?
Well, it's interesting because that was my first comment, but then the second one is, in the midst of that, really what you do as faculty member, you go in and you talk to students, and they're completely oblivious to what's going on. They have no idea that their budget's been slashed and that you have to have more students in there. I mean, they don't understand that. And I had one student who, this semester, was in a massive car accident, and she emails me at midnight. And I get the mail the next morning, because she didn't show up for the exam, and I was wondering what happened. I checked the email, and she says, "Dr. Sorensen, I'm writing you this letter from, you know, I just got out of the ER," and she talks about how she's been cut out of the car with jaws of life and everything. But she says, "I know that you're a Christian, and so I want you to pray for me." And I was going, wow, okay, that's not the email that you get every day. So it was really, that was cool. So she was sustaining me. She didn't know it, but you get those little,
Things. And you sometimes don't even notice them. That's what, sometimes when I've had a really bad day, I just deliberately say, okay, what was it in this day that was sustaining? And I'm surprised at what was that I just dashed over because I was so overcome by what was tearing away. Yeah.
So you talked at the beginning about practices, and this reminds me of a time in my teaching career when things were pretty bad at my school, and I came back, I think it was after the summer, that the theme at Holden was 40 years in the wilderness, so really the same
40
Exodus.
Years. Okay, you got 40 years, we've got that down.
Well, it was the anniversary year, so we've been reading those texts, and I had this resolve that I was going to look for the quail, and that I was going to notice whenever there was this sort of unexpected food. And I put that on my screensaver picture of a quail, you know, just as a kind of reminder to try to notice, even if those things that were sustaining were in some ways peripheral to the work. And then that reminds me of that when I first started teaching, I'll never forget this advice from a senior member of the faculty who said to me, "Deanne, you can't depend on your students to keep you going. You gotta have something else. Me, I ride motorcycles." and when it's counter to what you're saying, except that for me it was a very useful reminder about why I do what I do, and that it can't be only because I expect to come in every day and have my students be so glad and so engaged and my colleagues cheerful and pleasant, because they aren't always. Actually, neither am I. So that it was just a really nice, you know,
that's a lovely image.
You know, and then he could bring his sort of good cheer to a young colleague. It's a ball.
I'm a teacher too, and I teach large classes sometimes with 300, 400 kids in them. And when I do that, I have staff teaching assistants I work with, and lots of times these people I haven't talked before. And they come back to me with horror stories, because occasionally you get that kind of an email, you know, where, and it's kind of, it's a, and it feels good. But lots of times when you're working with kids in that kind of setting, they're not such pleasant experiences, and the teaching assistants come back and they're, you know, 2 months before they were undergraduate students themselves, and they develop this sort of real antagonistic kind of relationship with the environment they're in and with the kids they're teaching. And so I've always viewed it as one of the things I have to do for them is to remind them, and this is terrible, I'm not sure, don't tell anyone I say this, but I tell them they always have to be aware of the 10% jerk factor. And the 10% jerk factor is that, you know, most of the kids you run into are the ones that are going to try to manipulate you and are going to try to get out of something and are going to try to play the system. And you're going to run into those kind of kids on a regular basis because they can't do what they want to do without interacting with you. But you've got to remember that that's just the 10%, you know, and you really have to work really overtime to not that, let that cloud all your relationships with all your students and to develop this sort of hostile kind of negative attitude toward the people that surround you. Because I think it's the big, especially when people are dealing with people on a regular ongoing basis, I think it's really the danger. Mm-hmm. And I think it undermines the spirituality of the workplace because ultimately the spirituality, for me at least, is always anchored in those relationships and trying to, I mean, I don't do well when I become really isolated. Mm-hmm. And so, and I slide into that too. You know, when you slide into the situation, you start generalizing on the basis of experiences you've had, negative, maybe like, you know, 3 bad experiences in a day, and you know what the 4th one's going to be. And so it's kind of self-discipline of a sort, a spiritual discipline, I think, to really say to yourself, no, every new one's a new one. And there's no reason to generalize on the basis of the bad. So, at least for me, that's what it's anchored in, is the nature of those interactions.
Yeah, yeah. And most, I don't know what all you're doing, but I saw your hand raised over here.
Well, I've been in community health, mental health for about 15 years, and sort of stayed ahead of the wave of funding up and down over all that time. And in management now, I sometimes think I should be on the other side, sort of advocating for change from that direction. I advocate for the people I supervise, but it's different when you're in management. And the program I'm in now is satisfying because the clients are encouraged to work and are given opportunities through people who do nothing but develop jobs in the community. They're real jobs. They're not just sheltered workshop shop kind of things. And when somebody succeeds, it's just pretty electrifying. And it makes such a difference in their lives. Get out and have something to get up for, and I mean all the things you've been talking about as far as work makes a huge difference.
It does make a huge, And it is, I mean, and a lot of us probably work in human relations type jobs, teaching, or I'm not sure what all you do here, but there is an incredible, the relational dimension of life is so critical. And that, of course, is one of the things about in work life. If you don't have a relational dimension to it, what happens to that sense of connectedness? Because the other thing about spiritual formation is that my work life also tells me about what people are. Is it the 10% that I focus on, or is it remembering the 90%, or is it... one example, I interviewed a man who was a very ardent churchgoer and a Christian and really took his faith very seriously. And he was in upper management, and he was, his job, he was assigned this new job, which was to downsize compassionately. And so he went into, with this group of workers, who all knew that they were going to be downsized, they didn't know who. And he was trying to develop a system where it would be a compassionate firing. And he came back and he said to me, workers really are lazy and immoral. That's what he'd learned from his job, because the workers, I mean, I can understand perfectly, but he said, they cheat, they won't open up, they steal things from the company. And I thought, he had no understanding. Those workers knew very well they were going to be fired. They all knew it. And they knew the company was sending this guy in to try to pacify them so they wouldn't be angry and hostile and be destructive. And their resistance was, in fact, what was most spiritually enlivening about the whole thing. They were not going to be manipulated by his coming in and telling them that they should be happy about being fired. And so what I heard from it was their resistance to being going out gently into that unknown unemployment thing. And what he saw was that he, full of really good intent, wanted to help make this a good process. And so they, of course they were stealing from him, because that was sort of a way, again, to get back their self-respect. I just spent one day going through the welfare line one time, and I can tell you, at the end of the day, I wanted to cheat just as much as I possibly could. I had been so demeaned all day and told how stupid I was and what a lousy person I was that I wanted to get back at them. That was my response. And so it's very, you know, it's very interesting what goes on. Yes.
Well, it is very interesting to have you say that about resisting and then about wanting to cheat in the welfare line, because I was also thinking that one of the things that's sustaining for me is the reminder that what I'm doing only matters so much. But it doesn't matter completely. And one of the ways that happens is by being able to laugh.
Yes.
I'm chair of a department. I remember this meeting of the women chairs at my college, sort of unofficially and irregularly. And there was a woman there who had been there before. She's listened to us all go, and they said, "Well, why do you do it?" Wonderful question. And one of the things I said was, people laugh in my department meetings now, and they didn't used to. Partly I was glad that I had done that, but also I took it as a sign that people were willing to say, what we do is really important, but it's not everything, you know? And because otherwise it gets a grip on us,
We
become captive to that work, whether it's working in a factory or running a company, whatever it is, it can get that grip as if this is everything about me.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's from God as a gift, and then this relationship. So one of the great gifts of working short or long term at Holden Village is it's always really clear to you how what you do affects somebody else.
Yeah.
Right? So if you decide to use more electricity than there is,
you know
who has to run up and restart the hydro. Right? But also if the electricity goes up and you're the one who runs up and starts the hydro, you know that you've done something for everybody here.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So, you know, I didn't want to get up in the night to do this, but it had this effect. So that the scale of the relationship makes it so visible.
Yeah. And why? And that people volunteer to do this says something about wanting to have that connection in our lives. I think that is a thing about how, but as we say, the prior thing is, I think, one of the deepest spiritual gifts you can have is laughter. And I did a test one time about what would make me, what would be a good work situation for me. And I went through all these tests and everything, and it came out that I could do almost anything because I'm such a generalist. But there were three things I needed. One was I needed to work with people who shared some similar values. I needed to have a team that shared values with me. The second thing was, I forgot what the second thing was. But the third thing was, they needed to make me laugh.
Yeah.
And then they said, well, you can do almost anything now if you have that criteria established. I thought, well, that doesn't exactly narrow the field. But that factor of being able to not take, I mean, to know that in some sense we're absurd. We're passionate and real, and we're kind of absurd. I love that sense of myself. You know, slightly absurd. Yeah. Others who have, might have things. Yes.
I work for Xerox, and I constantly struggle with, you know, working, well, for a couple of things, working for a, you know, Fortune 500 multinational company, you know, what is the impact on the world and what is my piece in that? And also just for me, there really is no, I don't feel like there's a direct connection to, you know, how am I adding value to the world? You know, if there were no more printers or copies, copiers, would that be such a horrible thing?
Yes.
You're being affirmed right here and now.
I mean, I know there are people who use them for good purposes. But anyway, so I struggle with that a lot, and whether, you know, this, whether a person can work for a company of that size and have real meaning in the work. And I guess the one place I do find meaning is again with the relationships with coworkers and working on, you know, sort of side things within the corporation. At the site I work at, we have an environmental committee, and we, you know, at lunchtime meet and plan different activities and things like that. So those sorts of things nourish me, but it just sort of the whole weight of the larger system weighs on me, and it's a sort of constant struggle.
You know, what I would wish is that our churches would be places where we wouldn't feel guilty about discussing that. Where, you know, or not guilty, but I mean, where it would feel really great to go and raise my doubts or my questions, not because someone say, yeah, you should, because we're all in this system together, and there's no simple answer to that question. There is no simple answer. But together, we might be able to widen the arena of what's possible. And that's what I would hope for our lives together, as that I could go back to this community of people who share my values, but don't immediately assume because I'm in business or because I'm a teacher, there's certain things that aren't problematic, and there aren't certain things that are really good. But there are some questions that I would really like to sort out. Is this where, you know, and I just find that doesn't happen very often. Or, again, what I heard again from people when I questioned, they said, if I'm in the business world, the church has nothing to say to me because it doesn't understand the complexities. That's very sad. Because maybe I don't understand your complexities, but boy, you know, if I don't believe that you have as much integrity as I, then we can't start the conversation. So, and that's what I hope in terms of our spiritual deepening, that it's a communal spirit too. When I'm down, you can maybe hold me up, and when you're down, I might be able to hold you up and see and help you see things there that weren't there, or make tough decisions. I was talking to someone, she's not here today, but how she said she struggled for about 6 months to decide to really change her job. And then after she made the decision, she went, I wonder what all the struggle was about. I've never been happier in my life. But if we have a lot of fear about, and it's that, that's what I said, the spiritual thing, going back to make true what is true, to deepen our ability to be less fearful and more open-hearted. And I keep putting those two things up for myself. What is happening here? Am I becoming less fearful or more fearful? Am I more open-hearted in this situation, or am I beginning to close up, you know, with the students? I had such entitled students this year, let me tell you, I was having a hard time. I really had to think about my heart. It was closing up on me. So those are the, you know, am I helping make true what is true? That's very...
It really is. I think it really is. I'm sort of reinforcing this. I really think it's possible. Well, it's possible to create this environment where we devalue some kinds of efforts and some kind of engagements and work efforts that really, you know, and it's a tragedy when that happens, I think. And it came through to me really clearly when I was a high school senior. And it was in 1969 in Los Angeles, and we were full at that moment in that place, and none of us trusted businessmen. And we had a teacher, and I remember him saying, it seems so obvious now, but at the time I was totally knocked off my seat. He said, you know, he talked to us, you know, there's nothing wrong with being a businessman and creating jobs and well-being and livelihood for individuals so that they can prosper and do good things with their lives. And I've never, ever thought of being, you know, that was what businessmen did. I mean, you know.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, I mean, I think it just, and so I think it is part of what we should be doing is to understand and help one another understand what the nature of their calling is, wherever it happens to be, whatever they're doing.
And we're all implicated in this. We're implicated also in the tragedy of it. I, as a teacher in a seminary, live off of your income. Mm-hmm. I live off of the stock market. I live off of the rich people who give money to the seminary. I live off of the capitalist who's making money. I am a, you know, there's no such thing as purity in this. There is the need for us to think together as clearly as we can about moving toward what we believe is better, but not because I'm less implicated in it than anybody else. My immediate job may seem to be more relevant in some ways, and hopefully it is a relevant job, but I am living off of other people's largesse, and I'm not unentangled from this system. And so it's a matter of all of us struggling together to try to push the systems with which we're in into ways that are less destructive. Not saying I'm out of it and you're in it, but how do we together?
And I think there are ways that congregations can help support that, even if they're very small. I mean, one thing that a couple of congregations that I've been at do on Labor Day is members of the congregation stand up and talk about where does God intersect with their work. And so, and I know that sometimes when people are asked to do that, they think, wow, I haven't really thought about that. But then as they think more and they share their testimony eventually, you know, it's perfect. And the things that people say, I mean, I move to tears every Labor Day whenever I've heard stuff that people share. And then I know at another congregation where there was a recession and people were losing their job, they formed support group for the people who were looking for work, and so they started their own network. And I don't know if that's still on. Christine, was that
on and off?
Yeah. So I mean, they still do that.
Yeah.
So I mean, and congregations, I think, in their own places, probably can figure out how to support people in that. I thought it was really interesting the other day when you shared that business people didn't think that pastors had much to say to them in terms of.
What they got out of the worship
service,
that
the
would help
service.
Them in their daily
life.
Yeah,
it didn't help that much. I find that really interesting, and I think it's important that those people tell the pastor that, because obviously, you know, he or she is not meeting the needs that they have.
Right.
So.
But at the same time, we have to be really careful to say that if the pastor not getting it doesn't mean that the church can't do anything.
Right. Exactly.
So
right.
I think about also the ways in which small groups of Christian people can be supportive of each other. And it doesn't necessarily have to be that the pastor is able to preach about this.
Right.
But
because God knows some pastors aren't able to preach about it.
Which I'm not anybody. But you know, if there are the lessons, there's the sermon, there's the worship,
right.
The hymns, and so forth. And maybe what's needed sometimes is three people who have similar work,
right.
To say, let's talk about our work together. And if three people who are Christians do that, the church is doing something.
Right.
Yeah.
They are doing it themselves. It doesn't require that it's the pastor who does it for the church to be doing something.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that completely.
Which isn't to say that the other thing should happen, but I don't want us to fall into that view. So I'm sitting here thinking about our potluck group. You know, often we're talking about our work,
mm-hmm.
and then the church is doing something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, was it in here that I talked about the pastor who said people were not to talk about their work lives?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's very... It is hard to start some of those conversations because also it gets into issues about money and status and people's shame and people's feelings of privacy and what will you think about me if you know what I really make? How I spend my money.
Work in the
public
sector.
Everybody knows. That's right. That's what I say.
I do the Bread magazine. connection between, I mean, so. I'm, you know, there's a grand old Lutheran doctrine that deals with all this, and it's the priesthood of all believers, and it's sort of this radical, small-p democratic notion, you know, that every occupation, whether it be a paid occupation or any sort of an occupation, is a form of priesthood, and that, and then in pursuing it, we realize our mission. And, I, you know, it's worth thinking about in this context, I think.
Yeah. It's, and it can either be a liberating concept or a very static concept. I mean, we're always, it's always this tension between being respectful of each other and really hearing the other person from and listening very carefully to the other person, and collectively deciding what that we have to sometimes say no, or we have to challenge each other, or we have to say, is that what we should be doing? And that's where that tension about how do we listen and hear each other, and how do we also challenge our assumptions? Because one of the things I think about these, about groups talking with each other is again, I have been, as I said, part of this coalition for ministry and daily life now for the last 15 years, and most of the people in that coalition are much more evangelical than I am, or much more conservative theologically. It's the only place where me and Campus Crusade are together. We have some very interesting discussions. But a lot of that is directed toward significant people, business leaders. There's very little of that program that's directed toward daily workers and union issues. And in that, what happens is when I'm talking within my own group, I don't know how I'm really affecting people in another group. So one of the things in Christian communities is for us also to confront each other about how does my work affect you? From students, you know, listening to students' understanding of how they perceive me as versus how I perceive me. And I noticed this very clearly, because when I was a student, I wrote a little journal about things that I thought teachers were devastating when they did. And I just read it recently. Teaching professions, we tell each other stories that make us assume we're right about our analysis of what's going on and what the students are like. I mean, like I was realizing the other day, I'm into this whole thing about these students are so entitled, blah, 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 blah. I think they're. and all the rest of us, we're all sitting around griping. And I realized we were reinforcing for each other our perspective of the world. And there was distortion in that. There was distortion. And so part of my issue is when I see these groups that talk about their work in terms of their Christian thing, but assume that they know best how their work affects other people. And so one of the great things about a Christian community is trying to bring in people together, not only talk about our own things, which we need to do, but cross those lines, you know, to someone outside of IBM saying what it is they see, you know, so that you're not just your own internal things, but you can begin to see where it's good, what are the effects, what you should push for, what you should encourage, what you should challenge. But we don't know that by ourselves. And again, that's why I say spirituality is also a communal issue. My spirituality is a communal issue. I just can't discern it all in my home. I really can distort. And that's why it's so important to talk to other workers who come from very different. This year, I've been part of two groups. One's called Wages, which is women who are immigrants, illegal immigrants, doing housework. And they form these collectives that are doing ecologically safe house cleaning. I never knew how dangerous house cleaning was until I worked with them. House cleaning is one of the most dangerous jobs in the world. Did you know that? House cleaning? The chemicals that are used, the malformed babies they're having, their health issues, what it means to be on your knees, things that I had never thought about. This didn't cross my consciousness. And it's been so revealing to me about all kinds of things I know. So it's that crossing things. Well, we're back at the time again. So tomorrow I want to go on and talk about the world's work and how we understand ourselves in relationship to that, which seems so impossible, but I think there are ways to do that. And then on Friday, talk about what the church might do. So thanks again. Good to talk with you.